So we're going to do this kind of casual, non-hierarchically, right? We're not going to. it's like being in a
non-didactically.
Campfire. Non-didactically. Okay. Well, actually, maybe.
I was hoping my parables weren't didactic.
Well, let's. I mean, should we talk about this D word? Because okay, one thing I should acknowledge is that I mean, I have the honor to have been your colleague at the University of Illinois Chicago as film teachers, film instructors, and so we have a didactic role to play in that capacity, and given that we teach film, and here's a film that is about the imparting of meaning through history and the representation of historical events, and so what does the D word mean for you? All those.
Like death? I don't know. I have a complicated relationship, I guess, with didacticism. Obviously, I'm someone who likes to learn and likes the mini delivery methods that information comes to me, but there is nothing I hate more than. You know, being in the cinema and not being given the space to come to some of my own conclusions. And I I'm fine with being, you know, a structure leading me through. And like we were just talking about the film that Volker put in the program. Was it yesterday?
Last night, yeah.
Oh my God, it was just yesterday. Erzählen, the Faroukhi film, Erzählen, which I really respond to. I thought it was fantastic. And because he's sort of unpacking all these modes of telling as a way to give you, you know, that freedom, which I saw as the arrow pointing out at the end, to kind of contemplate which modes do I absorb the best, you know, which affect me more than others, and certainly something I'm thinking about in this, and which do I trust in more, which do we give more credence to, and why, you know, which seem to have more authority. I mean, he wasn't asking all those same questions, but you were saying, you know, he, as you were saying at breakfast/lunch, kind of sets up his question maybe a bit more clearly, and I do have a fairly clear question in my own head, but I think part of the reason I make work, in fact, maybe almost all the reason I make work is because I don't know, and I don't presume to potentially ever know, and I like being in you know, that place of unknowing is wait, who said that? Not Keats. Oh God. Negative capability. Who talked about negative?
I think it's Keats.
Was it Keats?
It's Keats.
Negative capability.
Yeah.
I mean, I really respond to that because I feel like if we're in a place of uncertainty, then we question. We question everything. We question the status quo. We're not comfortable. We don't, you know, we don't just like kind of go with the flow. And to me, that's a more productive place to be as a thinker. And I hope that I can help my students be in that place. And so I don't ever, you know, I'm not like, we're all buddies. And, I don't necessarily think of us all as... I don't know, totally equivalent, but it's absolutely the case that I learn always as much from them. I mean, it goes both ways. Mm. So I've never seen myself as, I don't know, I don't trust my own authority, or I have, I guess anytime I come to a place where I do trust my own authority on something, then I question it and I'm like, well, wait a minute. Then you're blind to something else, you know. As soon as you start feeling comfortable in your knowledge about something, and I don't mean, you know, let's throw knowledge away and like have this kind of anarchic like no knowledge is good knowledge, no, but just to keep in a place where you keep grilling it.
Yeah,
I guess. Yeah.
Well, I'll respond as an audience member. I mean, I've seen this film. This, I think, is the fourth time I've seen it. The first time was in Berlinale last year, and I remember at the end when I guess you want to call it the big reveal, where we get the, you know, the I guess the factual the reference points as to what these were referring to, sites and time, historical time frames, I started scribbling frantically and just like, okay. And then when I got the first opportunity, I got on Wikipedia and like looked up every one of those things I'm kind of curious what you think about that, because that speaks to this hunger for pure information. And maybe it's just, you know, it's the information age, it's the Wikipedia generation where we just always want to look things up and just have information at our fingertips. And this film is actively resisting that convenience. And again, it gets back to the didacticism question of like, what is knowledge good for? And
if you have no handles to hold on to the pieces, I mean, it seemed like for you, those locations that maybe where the citations came from were kind of like a handle to open the door a little bit, but I feel like that handle's different for everybody. I mean, I do think it's important that it's specific locations. It's equally the case that, you know, I want the parables to speak as much about that particular place at that particular time, and so then it's important to know, well, what was that particular place? But at the same time, I want it to be, you know, allegorical and be able to function. You know, if you hear one story of Exodus, it's really easy to, or persecution, or, believing, having faith in something or someone. I mean, it's easy to kind of to place that onto some other situation or recontextualize it into contemporary events or, sort of re-perform it to yourself vis-a-vis what stories you know about place and history and, obfuscation or whatever the case may be. But, I didn't want to leave. That's the balance of every film. Like, what's just enough? Sometimes in the process of editing, I'll remove too much and then I'll realize, like, okay, now there's no handles. And nobody can, drink the Kool-Aid because there's no glass or whatever. You have to sort of have just enough there that, obviously that's not going to be the case for every audience member. I mean, there's certainly no shortage of audience members that would feel like this film offers them no doorway in. And others who feel like, I have hundreds, or whatever, I have a lot of access points. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want it to be easy, but I also don't want to be so coy or obsequious that you're just like throwing your hands up, what the hell? Like, what does this have to do with this? So,
well, I'd like to think that the frantic scribbling was a good sign that the film had, an effect. It's like, oh, okay, it puts a certain onus and power in the hands of the viewer to kind of complete the story in through their own activities.
I mean, I think it's a good sign if you see some. I mean, case in point, at Salem last night, if you see something and there's no way I could absorb it in one viewing. It just was like, I want to see it again. Oh my God, wait. I was scribbling too during the whole film, but I couldn't see. My notes were all messed up. I couldn't read them when I got home. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know what I was trying to write.
There's something about structures of power with regard to knowledge, and you see that explicitly in some of these passages with the reenactments of the Fred Hampton murder. I mean, yeah, we can definitely call it a murder.
Re-reenactment.
Yeah, right, because you're reenacting historical archival footage of what the police did to demonstrate that it was all in self-defense, that that Fred Hampton, I think, had fired first, which was a lie. But they used this very scientific-looking, very procedural and very clinical reenactment using these wooden props to...
Yeah, they basically built a set that was to the floor plan of... the Panther house that Fred and others were staying in the state's attorney's office, and had CBS News come to film it. And it was shown that night on CBS News as the news, as this is what happened. But it was on a set that they had built in the state's attorney's office. And I had seen that footage in the film group's film by Mike Gray and others called The Murder of Fred Hampton. Was like, wait, what is that material? So what you see is my group of actors, people, non-actors, I had the sound playing back in the room. I built the set and then had the sound playing back as a loop so they could move in sync with the telling.
Right.
But then it also opens it up for me to allow their gestures to illustrate something else, like the Black Panther's version of events. And so their gestures aren't just tied to COINTELPRO and the state's attorney's office. I mean, I think it's just, it lets you see, oh yeah, versions of events can be worn by, you know, it's like, you can, a lot of people can put the same coat on.
Exactly.
And it has different meaning on the, you know, based on who's wearing it, I guess. It's a weird analogy.
Yeah, it's like,
it was, you guys know where I'm talking about.
It was like a remix version within the film, like okay, so this is the fourth time I've seen it, and like this time, I think it might have been because the 16mm projector's presence was so so present. You can hear it, and something about it was the audio visual properties were so intense compared to past times I've seen it, and it really brought out this quality of a war film. Like I felt like I was watching the War of Illinois over, you know, like what, a millennia. There is definitely the sense of like waves of violence sweeping across this terrain this time. And so I want to ask you this question about where does the violence come from? Is it, you know, is it in the land itself? Because it, sometimes you almost feel like the land is just encoded with violence, or is it just what human beings bring to it? And yet there's natural disasters, there's, you know, the tornado. It struck me that the last image is this. It's an art piece, right? It's this land art piece, and yet is it an insect?
Yeah, it's like I think it's supposed to be a water bug,
or what
are they called? Like a water spider? Those little kind of mosquito-y looking things that skate around on the top of water.
Because it had me thinking, like, is this land plagued? Like, just by insects. My own reading.
Wow.
But then the question of violence, because you as a filmmaker, I feel like you can call it a counter violence. Like you're enacting violence upon the smooth plane of history. Like just the, you know.
Wait, you think the plane of history is smooth?
Well, you know, that leads to another question I want to ask you. But this is enough for now. But what? So violence.
I mean, that's like, you know, shitty news sells, right? I mean, I feel like that's what gets written down. You don't remember the eventless times. You know, you remember the crazy. When if you're going to tell someone a story of your dream, you're not going to be like, in my dream last night, I brushed my teeth. You know, you're going to tell them the time when you were like, and I was like, I'd mow down the whole, I don't know, something we tend to record and remember the dramatic times. But also I feel like, yeah, it's, well, whatever, we're a pretty violent species. Yeah, we're just shitty to each other. I mean, I think there's also, I'm attracted to the kind of catharsis that comes from a wiping clean, and maybe I think just on some level humanity is attracted to that, even if it's like unconscious. I mean, I think the scourge of a mile wide tornado, which is what that tri-state tornado is, like a tornado that crossed three states and was a mile wide, just erasing a mile of stuff. Thinking about that alongside or followed by the critical mass equation that led to the first nuclear bomb, and having suddenly the power to erase on the scale and beyond the scale of that tornado, there is a euphoric power that comes with recognizing that kind of capability to erase history. And I think at some level, it's not, you know, I mean, I've my practice, and I know, I guess I've made films about theaters of war for sure in the past, and sort of what the kind of potential energy, or not, what do you call it? Like when I think about how many people have guns in the States just walking around all the time, I feel like everybody has their own black hole just on them, and like the potential that we could all just get sucked into it. There's some kind of really profound, I don't know, it's, catharsis isn't quite the right word, because of course, you know, if you die, I don't know, that's something beyond catharsis, but radical shift of register, I guess, that I'm not saying we need it, but something about, yeah, that being close to that precipice of being erased is makes you pay attention a little, or be aware of it, or we start paying attention to history. And of course, history is not that. History is tons of small nothing moments.
This is too. So I was curious just how canonical these 11 instances are in, like, I don't know if you've consulted like Illinois state history books, if such things exist for
yeah, they do. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say maybe not so canonical. I mean, I don't know, if you ask someone like, what are the formative things about Illinois? They'd probably be like, well, the Chicago Fire, and it's the land of Lincoln. Abe Lincoln was from there. But although that's contended, there's a lot of states who are like, no, he was born here. No, he lived in this log cabin. So I didn't want it to be canonical in that sense. But I think in some of the stories, I guess canonical to me, they are.
I mean, canonical to the Mormons, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think a lot of us know about the trail where they cried, or the Trail of Tears, the purging of all of the East Cherokees and the East Coast Indians to Oklahoma and places further west. I mean, that's, maybe it's not canonical, but it's a story of expulsion that's fairly well known, although maybe not so many people know that more of sort of those who were expelled died in Illinois than any other state, because they were stuck by the ice and the river. They couldn't cross the river because it wasn't frozen solid. It was too many chunks, so they just starved to death and froze to death. So, I don't know, what's a canon, right? What is canonical? I mean, I feel like that's what the film asks on some level. It's like, why do we listen to some versions of history and not others? You know, so I feel like that's part of what the film's poking at in the first place.
Right, how is authority created and the story? Yeah. Okay, one thing I noticed was that the last, it's really like the use of actors, visible actors, because you have voice actors throughout, which I didn't even realize the tornado witnesses are all, are they all, I mean, how many of them are archival recordings and how many of them are?
So the witnesses that you hear when it's sort of like the archival footage and it's just people walking around on the street, those are all, you know, at the time they were still living witnesses from Murfreesboro. And there was about, I'm going to say maybe 9 voices that I used. And I went to Murfreesboro to research the tri-state, and in their, not their library, but like their community center, they had a VHS tape of that someone had gone around and recorded people who were still living at the time, and that was maybe in the 1980s. And so I took some of the voices from that film and used them in this. And then the other voices you hear when you're up in the air in the biplane flying over the erased section, those voices are from a YouTube video. So there's I love that about sound, that you can have these three totally different temporal concurrent layers, where if you did that visually, it's like, oh, it's superimposition, and it gets kind of hard to process and a bit too congealed or dense. And but with sound, it's they're clear to me anyway. It's like the Lunenburg Traveler stays in there as a kind of explaining a disaster when you're just sort of ground down from it through reaching towards faith, and this kind of I love their version of the song, the Lunenburg Traveler's version. And then you've got this kind of municipal, state/federal reaction to the disaster, which is like the tornado warning and the kind of meep, 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 and it kind of like a state construct. And then you have the present, being in the present, which affects you in a really different way when you start to hear people like, you know, screaming and the like. I don't know. Just it was a bit hard to hear actually in this on the optical in this room. But at least you know it's not. You feel its presence. You feel it's happening now, and it puts you in a really different place as a viewer.
You do this kind of telescoping gesture at different moments. The one I remember very vividly is like you have the a representation of the Trail of Tears, and then suddenly it cuts to children playing like in a field.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, the sledders, like, you mean? The people who are
the
sledding?
Sledders, right, yeah. Right.
I think of that as my Bruegel moment.
Your what moment?
Bruegel, Peter Bruegel, the painter, when he always painted like lots of little people in the snow kind of far away. Yeah.
but you have actors playing Enrico Fermi. I call her the Firestarter girl.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, Wynette McNeil.
Right, and then the reenactment, the Fred Hampton reenactment. And so, like, these are the only instances we actually have live actors. And so I find it interesting that they occur towards the end in the more recent events. And I wonder if there's a logic behind that.
No, in fact, for a long time I thought it was a big problem because it wasn't, it just so happened that those stories were ones I wanted to have actors doing. And then I realized, I mean, this film took a million different forms when I was cutting it, and it was definitely not always chronological. It just, it was the only thing that worked. And I was bothered when I finally, like, it has to be chronological. Because all of the enactments, except for Ravenwolf, who we start with, but he wasn't, well, he's an actor, but he's performing himself. I didn't tell, he just came into the shot. He was like a gift. I was just there filming the mounds, and I'm like, what's that drumming sound? And then that guy, I'm like, oh my God, who's that cool guy? And he just walks into the shot, and I was like, this is incredible. And so he's an actor, but he's performing a role he's made for himself, you know? And it's like tied to his connection to the history there, obviously. And so he's an actor in a different way than the actors we see later. But he gives us a bit of the present or a bit of the embodied at the beginning, because it takes a while before we get back to the embodied. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe when you hear it with the Washington, Illinois YouTube video of the live tornado sound, maybe that's, even though you don't see them, you sense the embodiment of them, of that happening to them in the present. I think it's in a similar way that you sense the present when you see Wynette, the Firestarter, or Fermi, or the Raiders.
And so is Ravenwolf like totally aware of the history of the space, and like is the Cahokia Indians, or even before that?
Yeah, it was the Cahokia culture. Okay. Yeah, well, he was deeply aware, and he came to the screening at True False, which was amazing, because I didn't know that's a festival, a documentary festival in Columbia, Missouri, and I hadn't seen him since I happened upon him. You know, it was early on when I was shooting the film, so like 9 years before, didn't have his contact info, and then someone, I don't remember, I think it was, he performed as a busker on the streets, playing music on the streets of Columbia, Missouri, and someone who knew him saw him in the film, and then he got in touch with me, I guess he found me online, and I had my mind blown, and he was in the theater, it was so awesome.
I mean, I find him just a very interesting, in a way, kind of doing what you're doing, which is taking an active role in reconstructing and fashioning history as a very personal. I don't know if. I mean, in his case, it's a costume, but it's more than a costume because he's really.
No, it's a belief system. It's a belief system. More than a costume. I mean, right. he's invested. I mean, and I think the film for sure is parable after parable of investment in a kind of. Either a technology or a kind of belief system, a faith-based, to me, technology and faith are kind of two ways around the same unknown, that you're just kind of reaching towards something to help you through something you can't process. And so, yeah, he's, you know, taken on that role to help himself, you know, because that's how he navigates his life, you know, or how he makes sense of it, or who he feels he is. I don't know. Like you were saying, owning identity.
Right. I've got Wikipedia. He's got the code. Anyway, let's open it up to questions. Anyone?
There's a mic, I guess, that's sort of like floating around. But if you're, you can just shout it out if you don't want to use the mic.
Thank you. I was kind of wondering how you use kind of nature in the film, because obviously you have this kind of capital kind of end, kind of, you know, these massive kind of, you know, storms and kind of ice that stops people, but you also have the kind of kids sledding and kind of playing on nature and kind of maybe not so aware of the kind of destructive capabilities of it. I was kind of thinking about in the way your film feels quite seasonal. It has quite a kind of, you know, it, to me it didn't feel like a war film, it felt like a nature film in a lot of ways. Maybe just talk about nature or something like that. Not a question, I do apologize.
I feel like I should do it in the tone today. And look at the bee. Did you guys notice the bee, by the way? I've never asked an audience this, but there's like in the section where you start to see the monuments marking the critical mass piles, they're like stones, and it's that kind of like very sort of patriotic orchestral music, and it's going like dun da dun, and the little bee comes. Did anybody see that, or is it like no? Ah. Anyway, that's like my nature. My nature, that and sort of the smiley hey dude. I feel like are the comedy relief, the big comedy relief moments. I mean, nature. I guess in the sense of yeah, I'm really obviously invested in landscape and like to see what it has to offer up and like kind of pushing at what it harbors and. I wasn't, I mean, when you're cutting, you do have to sort of be conscious of day to night and season to season, and because sometimes those cuts can be too confusing and really throw you off, but it wasn't, in this case, it wasn't an organizing conceit, but because so much of it is just the static kind of mute, slightly... hard to read gaze, I think, a little bit. Like, the protagonists are sometimes the music, I think. It's very... I use a lot more music in this film than I typically do, or these voiceovers, or maybe characters here and there, but we're, for more of the time, we're kind of in these spaces that... it's like the stage before the thing has happened or after it's happened, but it's, I guess... I don't know, I'm not really answering your question, but I like the space that... places provide. And what's, you mean, to me, the stories that are not language or that are not semantic language, like words, sentences coming out of someone's mouth or written in a newspaper or a two-dimensional painting, but the language that exists just in places, like what a mound says or how, you know, how it acts as a monument, how it acts as a story. Same thing for the path of the tornado or the path of the exodus of along the Trail of Tears, which those paths, by the way, are almost right on top of each other. They make like a very slight X. I mean, that's more how I was thinking about landscape is, you know, whether markers are there or not, but the way that these traces are... storytelling equal in my mind to or having as much agency or intelligence as the stories that are I don't know, formed with words or paintings or text.
I think you can see that in the very first shot, which is that majestic kind of panning panorama of the landscape, and as I'm looking at how the landscape is shaped, I'm thinking like it's a form of writing. It's how human civilization, if you want to call it that, has etched its story and it left its mark on the land itself, and you're left wondering, you know, what did it look like a thousand years ago? A thousand years ago.
Yeah, well, less squares, I think probably definitely less squares. Yeah, focus.
Yeah, thanks so much for this great film. Looking forward to seeing it a second, third, and fourth time. And I would like to know a little more about the music choices, because I imagine in certain cases a music or a piece might come to your mind just because the location is like this or the images that you made are like this, but then when it comes to editing, maybe completely different structural considerations come into place. And I really like the way you use these very different kinds of music. And I would also like to know what the, in the French part, I call it the French part, what this great song is. I've never heard it. But
it's a fantastic song, I agree.
And I just wonder if there was a lot of experimentation with different kinds of music. I guess so, but maybe you can just speak a little about your work with music.
Sure. That song, the French song, is by this totally rad French punk band called Les Portmental, like the mental portal, I think, is how, does anyone know how to say it right? Les Portmental, something like that. it's, you know, obviously a riff on Saïra, but with this marching. So, let's see. Well, speaking of that instance, I guess it definitely came after the fact that I learned I had been shooting in Nauvoo, which is where the Mormons had settled and then been run out, just because that was a history I knew about, and I was interested in it because they're really actively reenacting their own past all the time in that town. I didn't end up showing that, but every summer they do this like huge reenactment play of their own history, basically, as they understand it and have kind of mythologized it. And they have an old-timey reenactment village with people dressed up like John Browning, the gunsmith, and you know whoever else was there living there at that time. So when I was there, just researching and doing a bit of filming, I saw that plaque about the Icarians, who I had never heard of. And I was like, wait, less than a year after the Mormons were run out, these enterprising, like, I don't know, sort of secular socialists from France were like, here's an empty town. Let's move in here and start our like secular utopian society, which blew my mind. So then I thought, okay, well, you need a song to kind of accompany that, that sort of attitude, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a turn of events that, it's hard when you're shooting so statically to kind of let the passion seep in. So the music does that to a degree, and which is often why I don't use very much music in my films, because I feel like it's kind of a cheat to let the music do all of the emotional work or all of the work of suspense. But in this case, I felt like it kind of needed it. Maybe because the stories are a bit heavy, or because the stasis, it was tipped more towards stasis in some of my films, and I felt like I needed that. To me, a melody is a narrative, and I needed a bit more narrative moments in the film that were, you know, not necessarily, well, we talked about this earlier, not necessarily explaining something, but letting you feel a version of the story. I mean, I think the music operates for me the same way certain shots do, like seeing the sledders or lifting from the ground and the balloon at the end, where they provide a kind of more of a physiological, felt, more emotional response to something that's been explicated in a different way, but that maybe it's not as emotional. So I liked the music for that reason in this film. And I thought, the process of choosing it, in some cases it was just, I guess for the most part I came to the music later. It's not like I don't think in any case did I have a piece of music and know all along, oh, I want to use it in the film. Like when I heard the story about the parrot who was all black and then started singing Sweet Hour of Prayer, I was like, oh, well, I have to find Sweet Hour of Prayer. And then I asked my friend who's a DJ in LA, and he just plays, he's a sort of a blues specialist. And I'm like, okay, well, tell me all the awesome versions you know of Sweet Hour of Prayer. And that was one of the ones he sent. And so sometimes it was kind of a problem solving approach to the music. And other times it was just, you know, had the right tone. Oki Yong Lee, who's a composer I really admire, who has three pieces in the film. The one in the opening when you're in the hot air balloon doing the 360, and then one during the Fermi sequence, and I forget when the other one is, but I just find her to be a really inspirational composer. And when I use Jean, what is her name, Demessier, she's the French organist whose music kind of trumps Bach. So that's more of like an insider joke for me. I'm like, I want this lady, badass organist composer to basically stomp all over. Not that I mean, I love the Bach as well, but to me it's liberating. She performs musically the same work, I think, that Wynette, the Firestarter, the young girl, performs on Fermi and the critical mass equation. There's a kind of response, but an oblique response that's powerful, but like covert, I guess.
Yeah, thank you for a lovely film. I thought a lot about number 45, or Mr. T, as I call him, with a tornado. Like there's a storm raging right now, politically, both in the U.S. and here in Europe, and there's going to be a long one. But I think that there was two words that popped up, was like responsibility and possibility. For artists, responsibility as understanding history, but creating the future through understanding our history. But how can we shape tomorrow? And in relation to possibility, because like so many things are going in the wrong way, like with the NEA in the US, for example, and you know.
50 other government agencies.
Yeah.
It's a cesspool of depression and anxiety.
yeah, exactly. But like, how do we, as artists, because, you know, our heads are usually the first to go in a totalitarian societies and with power. Or like, are we, like, what is my question? Like, a responsibility to know our history, but also shape our future, and possibility in a sense, like, do we have any power? And like, these are big questions. And of course, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. Two words. So.
I don't know. It's do we have power? Yeah, let's just own it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think we should. We because if you say no, then you're not going to do anything. If you say yes, then at least maybe you'll keep poking at things, or you'll keep sort of turning over stones, or you know, whatever it is. I mean, I feel like it's okay to show, to be resistant in sort of backhanded ways. Like, I don't feel like there's one way to be resistant. I mean, I agree. Like, what happens to the public voice, and what happens to the performing of a identity, and what happens to performing critique when you're in a culture that, you know, you feel like, there's all kinds of them all over the world that just get totally shut down. And to what degree, you know, how can you be strategic about that voicing of an alternative perspective? I mean, I think, yeah, it's personally, I feel like it's part of my responsibility. And not every film I make takes that on. I mean, I definitely make more and less radical or historically involved, or films that are, you know, invested in social criticism of some kind. But I do feel like I don't want to ignore the anxiety that we and I am feeling, and sort of the repercussions of what it means to sort of not have a voice anymore, or have never had a voice. You know, how can you keep sort of offering up platforms for people you want to hear from that aren't the sort of status quo? And then how do you filter when there's so many platforms that you're just kind of like, I can't process how many there are. I don't know. I mean, you'll have to find your own. We have to all find our own ways through it, because that's the didactic. That's the predict. That's the prescriptive. I mean, really resist prescriptive political filmmaking. I feel like that's not that names something and then it leaves it there kind of it's the reason there's 11 parables in the film and not 12. It's like an uneven, it's a prime number, it's not settled, right? It kind of feels a little ungainly, and I think if you get something all explained and wrapped up and diagnosed, then where do we go from that? It's just a circuit, and it kind of is self-congratulatory, and it's not productive of a conversation that has other doors that open for other voices. I don't know, blah, blah, blah.
I'll add
to that.
Yeah, I mean, I found the most inspiring and kind of clearly articulated moment in the film also made me think of the orange one. It was the moment where you have the letter by Ralph Waldo Emerson directed at President Martin Van Buren for enabling the forced migration of the native population, the Cherokee population, and that totally resonates with what's going on with migrants today and how we're treating them and immigrants.
Stinky, so, right? Doesn't he say it's going to stink? I wish I could sort of like, I have a terrible memory for language.
I mean, it made me wish that Emerson were alive today to just express this dissent so clearly the way we need it to be expressed. And yet, there it is. I mean, it's history. Another thing about this film, like the deeper you burrow into history, the more you get hurtled back into the present. I mean, that's what I find to be one of the great successes of the film, and to be reminded that this isn't new. These things have happened time and again, and actually that makes you both angry and helpless and yet determined at the same time. Like, okay, we once more into the barricades, into the breach. Yeah.
Yes, it's nothing new. That's for sure. Yeah.
Hi, I think Kevin kind of touched on it earlier on, but I was wondering if there was something specific about, sections 9 and 10, which made you want to kind of like reenact and use actors. I think for 10, obviously you described the footage that exists, and I think I've seen it before as well, of the kind of police staging and stuff. So I was wondering if you could say, I guess, the thinking behind using actors in those particular sections of the film.
Ten with the reenactors, it was sort of, we already touched on that a bit. And with Juanette, why did I want to do that? I mean, I had her story very early on. In fact, those scenes were some of the first I filmed for the film, weirdly. I mean, I think to me now it seems weird. I guess I knew that Fermi and the critical mass equation were going to be part of the film, but I didn't know that would be enacted. I think it has something to do with her being a preteen girl, this figure that, like, their power is often just sort of ignored or, like, seen as hysteria, or they're just, I don't know, acting out. I mean, she was, as the news reports turned out, just sort of a pyromaniac, basically. I mean, she wasn't really a fire starter, but I loved that there was this sort of mass cultural, I don't know if you would call it guilt or not a pathology exactly, maybe anxiety, I keep using that word, but around, I think, because it was just a few years after the critical mass equation, the fact that her story was being explained by all these, like, it could be radioactivity, and it's like, you know, foreign, it could be our army activity, or people were reaching to explain these fires in ways that kind of hadn't before, and there was something about having her, this sort of calm, but sort of infinitely powerful young woman, which I feel like young women are. They don't have to be telekinetic. They just sort of are infinitely powerful, and I wanted to visualize that. And so in a way, you know, it's not like, well, maybe just all 14-year-old girls are telekinetic and we just like don't give them space to act that out. But I wanted to give it space, and I felt like there was something about the sort of voice that's less heard, or the power that's less acknowledged, being this one that has sort of rises to the top, not to the top in the film, but she has a kind of authority because we sit there and we see the whole start and we see her gaze. And there's something about, I think, how slow you see that little section unfurl, that her her kind of matter of fact, I don't know, she just seems so not banal, but you know, you're not going to see her on the street and be like, get back. You know, but I feel like it's exciting that someone that you would normally overlook does actually, we do, those people maybe do have that kind of power. And she's, yeah, she, I feel that there was, if I was going to embody something, a young woman is who I wanted to embody. I mean, I feel like so many of the stories we hear about history leave out women. And, you know, obviously this is a very kind of, I don't know, quirky, idiosyncratic history, but I like the idea of embodying it. Why else did, was she there? I guess those are the main reasons. She, by the way, her, she hasn't seen it, but her mom and her are about to see it in Ohio in a few weeks, and her childhood friend, who she had grown up with, this boy who's now a young man, saw it when I screened it in Chicago, and his mind melted because he was like, I always knew she was super cool. Like, suddenly this, his like childhood friend comes up on screen as like telekinetic. And this is, I had, because I filmed her, one of the first people I filmed, he was seeing her kind of 8 or 9 years prior. So it must have been quite a strange experience for him.
Yeah, quite straightforward. You know, with all you have said, how does the fact that you use film tie in with what you do in the film?
I think maybe for me, the most, the clearest way it ties in, although it's not something, it's not the reason I chose film. I chose film because it's a slow process for me to shoot it. When I shoot on film, I cut on film, which is very anachronistic, and it's a very slow way to work. And when I'm working on films that are about issues or problems or questions, philosophical, ethical, moral problems, I'm kind of trying to get my head around. I like working sometimes in a slower process. So that's, yeah, a big part of why I chose it. But I think the work it does just on screen is a different kind of witness. I think the way that, just physically, the way that celluloid physically gets changed by being in a place and having light hit it is, there's something very political about that in my mind, even though it's not like, I don't care that, you know, whether people think about that or not, but I think a kind of pilgrimage and a physically being shifted by experience, by being in that place at that time, is somehow embedded in what celluloid is. I mean, it's literally being written on by a place and a time, in a chemical, you know, physical way that's different. It's just a different way of writing. It's, I don't really have to work hierarchically in terms of, you know, film is at the top and then there's digital and then there's analog video. I don't work that way at all. I feel like all those mediums have their own authority. I mean, in this one though, it kind of made sense with just all the pilgrimages I was doing and what is it that witness means, and maybe it's somehow embedded in what film is. I mean, also I just love, this is with any 16 millimeter film I make, whether it's about history or not, it's just so seductive for me to look at as a viewer, just the swarm of grain, because it's micro movements, magnetizes your eye in just a different way. It's just physiologically different than how HD, which is very like sort of vacuum packed, you know, there's no swarm, and because there's no micro movements, your eye isn't attracted to it in the same way. So it's just also a different physiological type of watching that, and I think that I mean, I can talk about this now because it's over and done with. It's not something I'm actively thinking about every time I'm shooting a scene, but just when I experience celluloid, that sort of imprecision of the grain never being locked down has something, I think, to do with the kind of didacticism we're talking about and the kind of uncertainty and the kind of shifting and the kind of always changing, always morphing, breathing, that the film itself has a different kind of life, you know. And I know that's fine if some people who, you know, whatever, don't see that. I realize not all audience members are, you know, film fetishists, but for those who are, we can, your eye and your body does something different. My eye and my body does something different when I'm looking at celluloid than when I'm looking at digital.
Thanks.
Any other questions? How long did it take to edit this then?
Oh my God, a really, really long time. I don't recommend it, you know. I'm trying other methods. I like to keep changing how I cut. So right now I have transferred 16 to digital. I'm just seeing, like, well, what does that yield?
Yeah.
How different is the film that it yields? And I don't know. I'll see if I like the process or not. Obviously, when I shoot digital, I edit digital. I haven't tried shooting digital and editing analog. That would be pretty weird. But I suppose it's possible. But yeah, each of those different, you know, tools, processes, result in a different film, and I like honoring that. I mean, if I had cut this digitally, it would have been a totally different film, because
sure.
I sketch a lot faster, and you know, you don't have to like slog through all your reels and your bins, and the mag is horrible. Actually, there's nothing good about cutting sound on mag, so that I'd be happy to throw away.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all for
sticking
much. Around.
And is there any announcements we want to make? I guess you made them.
Just to say, there was one thing I forgot to say, was that Andres Titella, who was here on Friday night presenting 327 Notebooks, has very generously offered to do I don't know the term, masterclass, but to do an illustrated talk at Birkbeck. It's a free event. It's at 12:30 on Thursday. He's just going to show some material from his films that he's brought with him and talk about his filmmaking process to anyone who wants to come along and ask him questions. So if you're interested in the essay film, I think it was an exemplary essay film that he showed here on Friday night, but also if you're interested in the memory and the politics and the history of that particular part of Latin America that is Argentina, then I just invite you to come along. So anyway, could you just maybe finish by saying thanks once more to Deborah and
Thank
Kevin,
you.
Especially for that great
Kevin. Thank you. Thank you. Please come to Kevin's show on Thursday. On Thursday, we're mutual fans, and he's making fantastic work, which I highly recommend.
Thank you.